This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the collection of koans by Master Wu Men, the Gateless Gate. Case 36, meeting a person of the way, meeting a true person on the way. The koan. Master Wutsu Fayan said, "If you meet a true person on the way, greet them neither with words nor with silence. Now tell me, how will you greet them?" The commentary. If you can give an apt answer to the question, it certainly is a matter for congratulations. If you are not yet able to give one, be alert in every aspect of your life. The poem. If you meet a true person on the way, greet them neither with words nor with silence. I'll give them with my fists the hardest blow I can. Get it at once. Get it immediately. I've been thinking about, this koan came to mind as I was been thinking about our world, our beloved world, and the malaise that we are in the midst of, the spiritual illness that we are in the midst of, which is not new. You know, the Buddha has been described over the centuries as a physician, a great physician who was able to recognize the illness, the fundamental illness, delusion we call it, and understand that illness so deeply that he was able to, within himself, heal himself and then establish a path by which we could all come to that great healing. And the great burden of the bodhisattva, of the enlightened being, is in realizing self-nature and the nature of others, is realizing that that illness, which has such tremendous consequence and is regrettably so much of our history, human history, and causes so much suffering, is based on smoke and dreams. It's based on illusions. It's based on shadows. You know, if delusion was true, if the self was solid, if we were fundamentally, essentially separate and distinct from everyone else, then I guess we would just have to do the best we could, right? Which is kind of what we do when we're in delusion, do the best we could. But that's not the way it is. That's not the way things are. That's not the nature of this world we live in. It's not our nature. And so the burden of the bodhisattva is the more we see that to be true, in a sense, the more painful it is. The harder it is, in a certain way, to be in this world and to be so present in it and so present to that suffering, because we see how literally, absolutely, from an absolute perspective, it's not based on truth, it's not necessary. There is another path, and that path is within each of us. And so the Buddha, the great healer, spent his whole life presenting us with a course of treatment, if you will, which ultimately takes us on a long journey through the course of which we realize we have not taken a step, nor did we need to. Master Dogen said, and so I've been thinking about that in terms of, you know, how we meet each other. How are we meeting people who have gone on an incredibly arduous, frightening, unimaginable journey, leaving everything behind? How are we meeting them at the border? How do we meet each other? How do people in Congress, our great lawmakers, how do they meet each other? How do we meet the president? How does the president meet his people? How do we meet ourselves? The Buddha realized this really is the fundamental. Because how we meet ourselves is how we meet everything. We may think that we can categorize and compartmentalize, but that's part of the illusion. Inner and outer, there's no boundary. And so that's why this koan came to mind. How do we meet each other? How do we meet a true person? What is a true person? Is there anyone who isn't? Fundamentally, Bodhidharma said, when we don't see things as they are, then everything that is true appears false. The world is filled with falseness, and then we build on that. We base our lives on that. And the falseness is compounded. When we understand things as they are, then everything that appeared false now we see is true. Master Dogen spoke of it this way. He said, to study the way is to study yourself. To study yourself is to forget that self. To forget that self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things, by the whole world, the phenomenal universe, everything. And to be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas is to free your body and mind and the body and minds of others. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to alleviate their suffering. In the moment of the Buddha's enlightenment, all beings, all creatures, past, present, and future, were freed within their body and mind. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this traceless enlightenment continues endlessly. There's no end to the path. And so in that very often quoted passage of Master Dogen, he in a sense gives us the whole path, the whole journey. All that we do, all that we will do in Buddhist practice is expressed right here. Our job is to enter into that, bring that to life. But then he goes on to say, when first one seeks the Dharma, one is far away from its environment. And so now, having presented us with the whole thing, he says, okay, now as you take your first step, just know that you are far away from the environment of the Dharma itself. Not in truth, but in our minds. And so the journey begins. How do we close that gap that doesn't exist? How do we let go of that separation that is nothing more than illusion? How can we be far away from ourselves? How can we be distant from the present moment? How can that which is impermanent in its very nature appear as permanent? How can that which has no abiding self appear as having an independent, self-existent nature? How can that which appears to be good and the promise of our happiness be suffering? The Buddha said, this is what we have to clarify. This is what practice helps us clarify. And how can any of these be true? The illusion of our mind, mind's illusion. And so what is it to study oneself? And so we enter and we're given instruction in Zazen. We take our seat on the seat of the Buddha. We take up the posture of the Buddha. We're not walking in the footsteps of the Buddha, but we are inhabiting the body and mind of the Buddha. Our Buddha nature. And then we stop and we turn the light around and we examine. We see. We calm the restless winds, the turbulent seas, so that we can begin to see clearly and more clearly and more clearly and allow what is naturally peaceful to be peaceful. And in that, we're seeing the habitual patterns as we study the self in our words and stories and narratives and fantasies and beliefs and grudges and resentments and triumphs and moments of saving the world. And in every moment, that one, that self that is being studied, comes and goes within those desires, within those longings, within those plans and expectations. And the Buddha said that self cannot be relied upon, and it is what we have to study. And when that stirring, all of that movement, all of that restlessness begins to calm and ultimately cease, when there's no longer turning this way and that, no longer seeking, when all of those many, many expressions of this, that which we call ourself, fall away and are realized as having no existence beyond that thought, beyond that idea, that within this present moment experience, there is just this present moment. There is no self to be found. In that moment, then all over the body and mind, all throughout the body and mind, the body and mind is freed of body and mind. Freed of grasping, freed of that sense of incompleteness and insufficiency. Freed of the illusion that if we just get this, or just get this in place, or just organize that a little better, then we can finally get our life back, finally start to live. Then our life will be what we hoped it would be. In that moment, there are no words, no beliefs, there's no Buddhism. But in that moment, the grasping mind is not yet exhausted. In the next moment, it appears. And so Dogen says, no trace of enlightenment remains, and that traceless enlightenment continues endlessly. The path continues. Wu Tzu Fayan was a very important teacher, Chinese teacher in the 11th century. And once he said to his Sangha, when hearing is shallow, realization is deep. When hearing is deep, then there's no realization. What can be done? What can be done? Making a true offering to Buddha doesn't mean giving more incense. How do we make a true offering to Buddha? Realizing Buddha. How do we repay the debt to those who have come before us, who have allowed and made it possible for us to be here today? By realizing ourselves, by practicing. On more than one occasion, I went to my teacher, or in Dokusan, I said to him, I expressed my gratitude to him, and in so many words, and in different words, said, how can I ever repay you? His answer was always the same. I already knew what the answer was. His answer was, fulfill your vows. Practice your vows. Realize yourself. He didn't need anything from me. But that. When we encounter the Dharma, there is realization, but it's not yet clear. That's why it's a path. That's why it continues. When practice and realization drops away, then the encounter is deep. The hearing is deep. And that's the great vastness and the great challenge of the Buddha Dharma, that nothing is fixed. The Buddha has no fixed form. Enlightenment has no fixed form. There is no thing to attach to. But because of the deep, deep, deep roots of that grasping mind, that we have to practice and practice and practice, letting go, letting go, letting go, seeing through that illusion of attachment. Within our delusion, within our enlightenment, attachment to the self, attachment to no self, attachment to holding on, attachment to letting go. And so, to bring it home, Fayan says, if you meet a true person, Master Linji said, there is a true person without any rank, without any signs, without any high and low. You can't measure them. They're free of complete and incomplete. So Fayan says, if you meet such a person on the way, greet them, not with words, not with silence. Now, how will you greet them? How will you meet this person? On what ground do you stand? How will you meet them? And of course, what he's really saying is, how will you meet yourself? He could have just said, if you meet a true person on the way, greet them. How will you greet them? And so we might say, being sincere students of the Dharma, in loving kindness, in compassion, sympathetic joy, in equanimity. And we would be right, but not right. And so, to ensure that we look more deeply, Fayan says, as you greet them, don't use words and don't use silence. So in a certain sense, our first answer was still true, but the mind wasn't true yet. What is loving kindness? What is compassion? Sympathetic joy and equanimity. How do we meet someone resorting to no fixed idea, to no duality, to no self and other? How do we greet them resorting to nothing, relying upon nothing? How do we greet them free of any preconceived idea of self and other? He says, don't greet them in words and ideas, but at the same time, you can't avoid words and ideas. Don't rely on silence and stillness, but don't be afraid of silence and stillness. Another time, Fayan said, it's nothing other than your ordinary affairs. How to meet yourself, how to meet others, how to meet every moment. It's nothing other than your ordinary affairs. But according to your thinking, he's talking to the ordinary person, the ordinary practitioner who's seeing things from an ordinary sense. He's saying, but according to your thinking, it is something different than ordinary affairs. If you think you can understand through speech, then know that you haven't yet penetrated the Dharma. If you think you can't understand through speech, then your head and mind are like a raging fire. So just pass through the gates, the barrier gates of the old masters. Don't betray the ancient sage's compassion. How would we do that? By not fulfilling that within ourselves. It's nothing other than ordinary affairs. And this is presented over and over and over because we need to hear that over and over, because in the beginning we don't buy it. Because if it was in our ordinary affairs, then we would already be enlightened. Our lives would already be peaceful. And so this is the great challenge of the Dharma. This is why the Buddha, in some measure, hesitated to teach, because he thought, how do I convey this Dharma, given what Dogen said, that the moment we begin seeking, we begin to move away from the very thing we're seeking, right? Because we look elsewhere. How do we meet a true person? How do we meet this true person, the person sitting on your cushion? The mind objectifies. It sees things. It creates images through eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, through the mind itself. And then that image itself becomes an image to the mind. And the mind begins relating, in a sense, to itself, with the object in front of us as sort of a supporting actor. Right? They're not the main actor anymore. They're not the main show. The main show now is our own mind, our history, our karmic instructions, our associations, our desires. But we don't see that happening. We don't see that happening. That's why it's so challenging. We have to see it happening. And in order for that, the mind has to return to its natural state of clarity, of power, of its natural ability to see into that subtle truth. And so when we hear people, friends, ourselves, family, people who have great power, speaking about other people as though they are creatures, animals, vermin, infested, living in infested places, who should go back to where they came from. What we're seeing, this has nothing to do with the people that they're talking about. What we're seeing is that person's mind. We're seeing that person's karmic obstructions. We're seeing that person's delusion. We're seeing that person's hatred. We're seeing their delusion. We're seeing their lack of understanding of their delusion. We're seeing their lack of compassion and loving kindness and sympathetic joy and equanimity. It's all on display. But if we don't see it clearly, then we mistake their words. And rather than seeing it as an expression of the speaker, we turn to the object that they're speaking about. People, real people. And things become confused. But they don't appear confused. That's why delusion is so deluding. Because it's built to be a perfect system. The system is just the way the world is. And it's built to not have any seams, any flaws. It's built to sort of be a stage that you can't look behind and see the people moving things around. And so it takes a lot of effort. But all the time, it's there are cracks and fissures and, you know, things are not working very well. And there are signs that it's not working. There are signs that it's just a stage. There are signs that it's not true. And bodhicitta arises when we realize, when we begin to lose our faith in the illusion. When we begin to lose our faith in the dream that we have, that we're living within, that is being presented as life and reality and the path to happiness. And we realize, no, this cannot be. This cannot be. And to think of the Buddha, who was, you know, had a very good life by all measurements. He was wealthy, he was loved, he had a great future ahead of him, as long as he didn't get killed in a battle. He had all the good stuff. And that he was able to see those cracks and seams within that world and see them so convincingly that he left it.
Wow.
I mean, literally left it and walked into a wilderness where there was nothing to count on. Right? He didn't have a credit card and a phone. And he took himself right to the brink of life and death in his search, in his commitment to find a way in. So deep was his conviction that there is a way to live this life that is peaceful. I mean, imagine that. He didn't have somebody before him. He didn't have an Eightfold Path. He didn't have 2,500 years of teaching. He was alone. Ultimately, he was alone. He had some help along the way, for sure. And in fact, the help that he had was the prevailing alternatives, other spiritual teachers who had, by their own words and their community's faith, accomplished it. He had the practices of asceticism, which was a whole nother path. So he went into those alternatives to that samsaric life that he was trying to resolve. And he realized in each of those that they were not the path. I mean, really. Think about what this person was made of. And had the confidence, but didn't yet know. That's faith. That's the power of faith. And through that path, actually worked out a lot of things that we don't have to do, right? Because he went into the ascetic life and took it to the brink of death. We don't have to do that, right? Because he said, okay, that doesn't work. No one could take this further than I did. That's what he said. I think he's probably right, given like what he was made of and how he went at things. So we don't have to do that. He said, no, it is a middle path. The poem, I mentioned this last time I gave this talk, which I don't know if it was the first time I gave it, but I avoided this koan for a long time because I really don't like this poem. And for various reasons, I gave that talk once before, and for different reasons, I'm giving it now, and now because of the poem, in a certain sense. If you meet a true person on the way, greet them neither with words nor with silence. I'll give them a fist with the hardest blow I can. Get it at once, get it immediately. Now, this collection of koans is within the Rinzai, the Linji school, and it's known for being very direct. It's not particularly beautiful, right? The poetry in this is not particularly beautiful. That's not its hallmark. There are, in the Book of Equanimity, those poems are beautiful, as well as being very powerful. This koan collection has a particular kind of signature quality, very direct. And this poem is that. And in fact, Hakuin, the great master Hakuin, also did not like this poem, so I stand in good company. He said, I do not like these last two lines. Master Wu Men committed a blunder. And then Shibuyama, who's commenting, says, rather than calling it a blunder, I should say that Master Wu Men is here being unnecessarily rough, showing off his Zen monkishness. As a person of the way has to be able to act more decently and peacefully in developing their Zen working. But, you know, when I think of this, and there's, you know, language, a lot of language in Zen that is oftentimes draws upon the warrior, speaks about battlefields and generals, and, I mean, they were drawing upon the culture of their time. But they're not drawing upon it in a critical way. You know, they're not making social criticism. They're drawing upon it as an analogy or a metaphor or simile to help convey the Dharma, right? Which I don't know how it was received at that time. But I feel like we have had enough. We need to find other ways. We need to have other examples. We have other ways and examples. We need to be inspired in other ways. And we are inspired in other ways. And what he's really saying here is, you know, this sort of the force of what he's saying is to shake us free of our grasping, shake us free of all of our dwelling, our attachments, our abiding in our conviction about the way things are, to essentially shock the system out of the system. And these were methods that were being developed and employed at that time, startling words, startling gestures, as a way of trying to bypass, to leap free of the intellectual, the conceptual, and go straight to the heart of it. And they can be very effective. They can also be misunderstood. And being influenced by their time and culture, which was a warrior culture, which was certainly patriarchal, and we still are in a warrior culture and a patriarchal culture, that hasn't changed, but it needs to change. Because all the while, the Buddha Dharma is based in loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity. That's its basis. Because that's our nature. The Buddha said, I do not bring conflict and suffering into the world, though the world may bring it to me. Ain't that true? We may be dedicated to not bringing conflict and suffering in the world, but the world definitely brings it to us. And so how do we meet our world? How do we meet this person? During this weekend, we've met each other. Hello, how are you? We've met each other in zazen. We've met each other in silence, in walking. We've met each other in past, present, and future. We've met each other in vastness. We've met each other in body and mind. And very importantly, we have met each other in trust. There is a sangha is not just a gathering of people. A sangha is a gathering of people fundamentally in trust. And in mutual relatedness that is based in that trust. And that doesn't mean the trust is an absolute. Stop thinking about absolutes. Enough trust in which to meet, in which to gather. And Fayan is speaking to all that, but really he's speaking, as all the koans do, to the fundamental. How do we meet? What is meeting? Because in actual fact, we have met before you arrived. And when you depart, you will not break that. You will not sever that. In fact, before you were even born, we had met. There is no stranger except in our mind. There is no other except in our mind. Stranger and other do not exist. But when they exist in our mind, then they appear to exist, and it seems true, in that mind. At the end of our inclusion statement, it says, when we see expressions of bigotry and hatred and oppression and ill will in our own minds and in our mutual relatedness, both within our sangha and in the world, we vow, our vow is as individuals and as a sangha and as a world community to respond with skillful and loving thoughts, words, and actions, so that we might put an end to suffering caused by them. May we together alleviate the fear and the hatred and the selfishness and delusion in our world. If we do not, we may not be long for this world. That's why these matters are fundamentally spiritual matters. To resolve the ridiculous issue of guns. It is ridiculous that we have not been able to make movement on this. What, if not that, is showing us what we really care about? We as a nation, not we as individuals. If we address that, as we address our climate emergency, as we address racial justice, gender justice, all social justice, as we address all of these illnesses, we should also understand that as important as that is, we're also addressing symptoms of an illness. We are not addressing the heart of it. The heart of it is, how do we meet? ourselves. That's the heart of it. How do we meet? And then, and at the same time, how do we meet each other? Because we can't, you know, we can't just sort of say, okay, I'm going to take, give me 10 or 20 years, I'm going to like go get enlightened, and then I'll come back and we'll talk about it, right? We'll work it out, right? Because then I'll be like in the zone, I'll be ready to go, right? But until then, right, it's not my, like, you got to carry the load. Can't be. And so from the very beginning, the whole thing's here. Self, other, inside, outside. Sacred, mundane. May we together alleviate the fear and the hatred and the selfishness. It has to be together. It has to be. That's why this madness of individualism, which is nothing but an idea and an illusion and a damn dangerous one. From a Buddhist perspective, that's a form of insanity. To believe in it, to perpetuate it, to make it a national creed, not only is not sustainable, it's a form of suicide. Not because it's an idea, not because it goes against the philosophy of Buddhism, because it goes against the way things are. The Buddha often said, if you take this path, you will not succeed. Another way of saying that is if you take this path, you will fail. To meet the self, to forget the self, to give up our clinging. The idea of I exist on my own apart from you, therefore what I do doesn't affect you, therefore I can do what I want because I can pay for it? Because I want it? That's enough? That's all that matters? And that's my right to have what I want? To be freed of greed, anger, and delusion. I mean, this is how long this has been going on, right? And the Buddha wasn't the beginning, right? He was meeting it at his own time. And he was dealing with the madnesses and the insanities of his time. And there were times where he would just walk right into the middle of it and say, you know, both of you, groups are getting ready to go to war. This is a bad idea. And sometimes he was able to calm those turbulent waters and stop it. Find a new path. Cut a new path. And sometimes he wasn't able to do that. And he stood and watched because he could not control it. And we cannot control it. And so he exerted all the influence that he knew to bring to it. Used his power, his position of power. And at the same, which was his compassion, and at the same time knowing, I cannot control this. These people, these nations have the right to suffer, have the right to choose delusion. And isn't that hard to hold that? Do we see that within ourselves? How we make those choices at different moments. We choose delusion. We choose our suffering at different moments. So, let's put our attention right there. There it is. Let's work that out. The Buddha said when we practice, as he often spoke of non-greed, non-anger, non-delusion, he said what we're giving to each other, it's not just that you're practicing not doing something, you're giving compassion, you're giving generosity, you're giving clear understanding. That should be our vow. That should be our common commitment. So when thousands and thousands of people show up at our border because they are desperate, desperate, that from within that commitment, The commitment is, we are one body. We will care about you. How are we going to do this? I don't know yet. I don't know how. We're going to have to figure that out. But when it's based in that commitment of loving kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity, that's the pathway that we have to open up. Whereas when we meet in greed, anger, and delusion, that's the pathway we've opened up. Those are the answers that we're going to find. The answers to that, to greed. Not to solving them, but to seeing the world that way. And so it takes a tremendous amount of courage, a tremendous amount of faith in not knowing. And it's hard to do that when people's lives are on the line and when people hold power and are responsible to other people and have to make decisions. I'm not saying any of this is easy, and I sure don't have answers. What I'm saying, though, is where do we begin? How do we meet this? That's what Fayyan is speaking to. When we meet, when we make a commitment to practice our lives, whatever path we take, we're making a commitment to engage this life from within these truths, within these qualities, these virtues that we're going to hold ourselves to. That's what a vow is. So when we meet difficulty, I don't know how to meet this, but my commitment is to do it so that I'm not creating more harm, not more chaos. I've chosen not that path. And so there are going to be moments where I don't know what to do. And so then patience, examination, asking for help, experimenting, being willing to fail, not expecting perfection. But until we have that commitment, and so to stand in that commitment is a most powerful thing. That's why we take vows. That's why we have great aspirations, is to establish that's the ground upon which I am committing to living my life. I'm not going to always make it. Right? I'm not striving for perfection, but I am demanding of myself that I do the best I can. And when we do that together, whoa, what kind of force is that? That's what a sangha is. It's just a group of people who are making that courageous commitment together. I do not argue with the world. It is the world that argues with me, the Buddha said. So this is, our great challenge, and it's always been so, you know, and that way nothing's new. But that challenge is seemingly much greater than before. The reach of our hand, the power of our intelligence has outpaced our spiritual development as a body. We're kind of like teenagers. You know, we've got these really strong bodies, but we're not quite, you know, inside of it yet. So we're flailing around a little bit. Sorry, teenagers. But we've all been there, right? So we're flailing around. We can't quite, you know, it's kind of disconnected. We bump into things. We make bad decisions. It's not integrated. And so growing up means catching up, right? Growing into that power. That's the importance of the spiritual path. I mean, I really feel at this point, it's not optional. It's not optional. And I don't mean Buddhism is not optional. But being awake is no longer, not being awake is no longer something we can indulge. We just can't afford it. And so however each of us meets that, I implore each of us, and I put myself right in the middle of that, to meet that. And my experience of that is that it's never enough, and you just have to be okay with that. That's part of knowing how to be satisfied, is with your dissatisfaction. It's part of really stepping into our completeness. The totality of our Buddha nature is making our peace with recognizing that our own individual power in so many moments is just not going to feel like enough, even our collective power. But it's what we have. And Buddhist practice is always about standing on this ground of reality, because there is nowhere else. And certainly there's no other place of power. Every other place is unempowered, disempowered, or a misuse of power. There's a story where Master Wutsu Fayan one day was telling his Sangha, and he said, "Yesterday when I went into town, I noticed a puppet show going on. I couldn't help going over there and taking a look. The puppet was really something to see. At first sight, it seemed to move its limbs and walk around and sit down all on its own. But when I looked closer, I could see there was somebody behind the blue curtain. So I called out. I couldn't help but call out. I said, 'Sir, what's your name?'" And so this very prominent, well-known Zen master. And the puppeteer says, "Honored priest, sit down and watch the show. Why ask who's behind the curtain?" And then Fayan says, "Friends, when I heard him say this, I didn't have a single word to say in response, nor a single idea to espouse. Can any of you say anything in my place? Yesterday, that single instance of embarrassment has uprooted all of my ideas." There is a time where we do look behind the curtain, our veil, and see clearly. But we could understand what he's saying is, don't try and get it all figured out. Don't try and rationalize and think that if we can explain it, we will have addressed it. Practice is meeting every step and knowing that the ground will rise to greet you. And so I really encourage, particularly those of you here for the weekend, to continue. To continue. Whatever it is that brought you here. You know, because when you know, whatever this experience has been this weekend, if it was a good experience, and I hope it was, and if you feel inspired or invigorated or committed, when you leave, that's going to change. I'm just telling you, it's going to change. Because everything is impermanent. All right? So don't try and hold on to that experience. But nurture it. Nurture it. It's a live thing. But like every live thing, if you don't feed it, if you don't give it attention, it will start to whimper, you know, cry out a little bit. But if you don't tend to it, it gets quieter and quieter, and then it will appear to go away. It's like that candlelight will appear to go out, but it doesn't. Because that's our nature. But so it has to be nurtured, like a baby, so it can become strong. So really, that's so important for all of us. And it's important for the world. This is what we need. We need everybody on deck, right? And in this seat of Buddha, in this enlightened mind, in these great virtues and compassionate heart that we all possess. So, may each of us realize the Buddha way, the enlightened way, which doesn't belong to Buddhism. And may we do that together, because there ain't no other way.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.